Welcome to episode 2 of season 4 of the Filmmaker Film Watcher podcast. I'm filmmaker Richard DiGregorio.
And I'm film watcher Greg Ralph.
So this episode, it is our Turn Back and Face the Music episode.
Yes, because what we're doing here is we're picking up on some musicals that we spoke about way back in season 1. Or when I say spoke about, kind of alluded to a bit. And and I think said each time, hey, we should talk about these films one day, and this is one day.
So the first film we're going to discuss is 2001's Moulin Rouge, the Baz Luhrmann film.
So that's one from the home country, Australia. And then we're going right across the other side of the world to Ireland, and we're going to do the 2007 musical called Once.
And then we're going into Bob Fosse territory in 1979's All That Jazz.
Well, I'm excited. My little jazz hands are actually going here, Ricardo.
Why don't you get started there, Greg, and tell us about Moulin Rouge.
You can pretty much explain the plot of this 2001 movie with two words and an exclamation mark. Baz Luhrmann. So, Ricardo, what did you think of it? Okay, all right. On the back of the successes of Strictly Ballroom and Romeo plus Juliet, Luhrmann sought to reinvent the cinematic movie musical. He mixes Puccini's opera La Bohème with the Greek legend of Orpheus, so that a highly talented poet-musician descends to an underworld of bohemians to find his love, but must return without her. The result is an over-the-top story that's a melange of musical, opera and melodrama, and an overwhelming feast for the eyes. And an assured and masterful filmmaker's hand is there from the very beginning. We start off a highly animated miniature conductor in front of red curtains which open onto the 20th Century Fox logo. After the overture, the curtains open again to take us down into an early film rendition of 1900 Paris, and then into the visual onslaught that is the music hall brothel Moulin Rouge. You will either go with it and throw yourself into this film, or be put off by the dizzying camera work, pounding music and movement, like my wife who had to leave the room. Through a fast-like set of circumstances, young Christian, Ewan McGregor in his prime, meets and falls in love with the courtesan Satine, Nicole Kidman. But Satine is supposed to be seducing the Duke, Richard Roxburgh, into becoming the sponsor of the Moulin Rouge's next big production, directed by the invisible hand of its owner, Jim Broadbent. Satine and Christian conduct a passionate affair, inventing excuses to be together, and for Satine to avoid the Duke's amorous advances, with none of the parties in this triangle knowing that Satine is dying of consumption. And then events reach crescendo on the opening night of their Bollywood-themed Spectacular Spectacular. Along the way, we bathe in a sea of familiar Australian faces. Christina New, Arthur Dignam, Jonathan Hardy, Norman Kay, Jacek Korman, Johnny Lockwood, Gary MacDonald, Kylie Minogue, Caroline O'Connor, Kerry Walker, David Wenham, Peter Whitford... And that's in alphabetical order. And Strictly Ballroom's Tara Maurice provides a Hitchcockian blink-and-you'll-miss-it cameo in the opening sequence. Ewan McGregor is a revelation, at times singing so sweetly and earnestly, while at other times belting it out with vocal strength and passion. There's an energy threaded through the film. Most of the songs are a mashup, before we even knew that word, teased and intertwined from the 20th century songbook, at least as far back as Nat King Cole's Nature Boy. There's a sense of delight and discovery as known songs are newly woven into a song and dance number and into the narrative itself. And I will always remember my moment of exhilaration when a dramatically charged tango sung by the unconscious Argentinian, Jacek Korman, morphed into Roxanne by the Police. It constantly feels like your adolescence is being reinvented before your eyes and ears. Our Baz pulls out all the stops and flings them joyfully over his shoulder. The film won Oscars for art direction and costume design, and also scored nominations for cinematography, makeup, editing and sound, as well as Best Picture and Best Actress for Nicole Kidman. I remember that Kidman said at the time that Baz sold her on the part by telling her, "You'll love it. She sings, she dances, she dies." It's just a shame that the film's central love song, Come What May, was ineligible for Oscar nomination in a year of low competition. And mystifying that Baz Luhrmann wasn't nominated for Best Director, for example, against Robert Altman's Gosford Park. This film is so vibrant in my memory that I can scarcely believe that it was almost 20 years ago. Ricardo, were you transported?
Well, I know that certain people have called this film over the top and over theatrical, but that's what it is, though.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, it's the closest thing you'll get to theatre in film. Even opening, as you said, with the conductor and the theatre curtain opening, I mean, that's what it's asking you to go with,
yes.
To be theatrical in the film. This film is so much fun. I love it. I really do.
And you know what I've just realised from what you've said? The film opens as theatre, so you've got mm-hmm. the conductor and the curtains, then it opens on a film logo, then it closes yes. again, then it yep. opens and it takes you through that old film-looking world and then back into the theatre. So it's actually shifting between them.
That's right.
As a way of flagging that we're actually going to mash these together.
Yeah, and it does it brilliantly.
Oh, yeah.
Baz Luhrmann's directing and style is just brilliant.
It's unique.
It's very unique. It's unlike anything you'll see. Roxanne is an absolute highlight. I just love all of the numbers are very good. I bought the soundtrack after I saw this film. I listened to it many times. It is wonderful. I mean, yes, it is frenetic. It is, the editing is just so much. But the thing is, it's not, I think the editing is just so brilliant that it's, even though there's so many cuts, I mean, I'd love to know actually how many cuts there are in this movie. It's just so many cuts.
24.
It's so frenetic. Yeah.
I don't know.
But they're all for a purpose. They're all for his style and his vision. I also love the medley in the middle on the top of the elephant.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
But every sequence is great. And
no, I don't agree.
No, I do. I think Like a Virgin's hilarious as well.
Do you? How did you know I was going to?
Yeah.
How did you know that was Like a Virgin I was talking about?
Yeah, I don't know. I thought you might not like that one. I don't know why. Maybe we've been doing this too long.
Okay, we'll just stop.
But I think that is hilarious. And I thought the character, Richard Roxburgh's character there, deserved his spotlight in the movie. And it was great. I thought it was a wonderful sequence.
Yeah, this is the only bit, I suspect, where we will disagree. I think I liked it when I first saw it, almost 20 years ago when it came out. I saw it on the big screen and I loved it. I think I liked it, but this time around, it didn't quite get there for me. I felt like I was watching something that was a cross between Disney and Mel Brooks. So it had that kind of, Disney Be Our Guest from Beauty and the Beast kind of feel to it. So you've got the waiters dancing around with Harry Vidler and the Duke, Jim Broadbent and Richard Roxburgh. And at the same time, it wasn't G-rated, so it was heading a bit towards Mel Brooks in my mind. And I don't know, it didn't quite work. And it made me actually think on reflection. And again, I think we're going to disagree about this.
Mm.
I think Richard Roxburgh was the weak point. I thought he was a little bit too hammy too often in the film. And I thought it really showed here.
Yeah, but that's the point. It is the point. What's he going to be? Too serious? I think he was perfect as the Duke because he had the slight menace, but he was quite funny. And I thought he was overly hammy, but for a purpose, and that Baz Luhrmann would have pulled him back. I think he's part of the vision. I think he's very funny. And there's that sequence there. There's a montage sequence when McGregor and Nicole Kidman are together and they're sort of wandering through the fields, and you got Richard Roxburgh finding like an insect or something, and he just goes to smack it down.
A frog,
that's right. Oh, a frog.
Had to be a frog because they were in France.
That's right. And I found that just hilarious. I mean, this is the point of the Duke. I loved it. I thought he was very, very good. But you know who really steals the show in this film?
Go on.
Jim Broadbent almost steals the show, I think, in this film. Jim Broadbent is a revelation. I think he's a revelation in this
movie. I'm trying to think what I would have seen him in before this. So he actually won a Best Supporting Actor Oscar for Iris for this year.
Yes.
So I knew him in that afterwards, and I knew him, obviously, in Moulin Rouge. I'm not sure if this was the first time I would have seen him.
Yeah, I don't remember the first time I saw him in a movie, but he's done so much. I don't think it was the first time I had seen him, because I didn't know who he was when I saw the movie. But he's so brilliant. The energy he puts into that role is phenomenal. And, I mean, the can sequence at the beginning is just so exhilarating to watch. But like I said, the editing is phenomenal in all of the sequences. But then the cinematography and the colours used, the reds, the blues, they complement the production design, which is very, very Bollywood. And there's a sequence at the end when they're in the theatre, which it's very Bollywood inspired as well, that whole dance number.
Actually, I know for a fact that I didn't particularly know who he was before Moulin Rouge, because the things he was in before that were things I'd certainly seen, such as Little Voice and Enchanted April, and there would have been other things as well, The Crying Game. But I didn't notice him. What I did notice him in before this was he was in the Red Nose comedy special about Doctor Who with Rowan Atkinson. Right at the very end, Doctor Who goes through various incarnations of different celebrities, and he was one of them, and I had no idea who he was. And that was only just before this film. That was about 2000 or so as well. Maybe slightly before. So no, I'd never seen him. And so to see him in this, he absolutely got my attention. But I think generally everyone's good in this. Really good.
Some people have said Nicole Kidman's way over the top, and especially in that sequence when she's trying to seduce Christian and when they were doing Spectacular, that whole sequence. But I think she's just so funny and wonderful.
Oh, no, I think she's nailed it.
I think she's nailed it in the whole film. But Ewan McGregor, their chemistry is what really sells the film. Their chemistry is wonderful. The Come What May song, when they sing that together, and her voice is gorgeous. They're both of them. Both of them I hadn't heard sing before, really. And they both nailed it. You know, character-wise, connecting to character as well as actually singing.
I should send you at some stage a link to something I watched as part of my prep, which was on the extras, which was when they first danced together during the whole rehearsal process.
Mm-hmm.
And they do this great dance, and they are just both in tune with each other. They're independent, but in tune with each other as they do this. It's not really a tango, but it's that kind of, ilk. And it's just wonderful, and it's really sad it didn't make it into the film. I think, yes, they've got chemistry together, and they both are standouts in their own right as well. And you and I have spoken in the past on this podcast, or maybe elsewhere, about Nicole Kidman. It really depends on what she's in and how she does it, for whether I like her or not.
And who's directing her.
Okay. So I thought she was fantastic in The Hours, in Paddington.
Brilliant.
I didn't mind her in Lion, the more recent Australian film.
Yeah, she was great. As the mother.
And sometimes I do find her cold. But sometimes I think she's absolutely nailed it, and I think this is one of them.
This was at a time when I think The Hours, she was doing a lot of really great work. I mean, she hasn't stopped. I mean, there was the movie Destroyer, which I really want to see as well, because she really transformed in that, which came out, I think, a year ago.
I don't think I've heard of that one. What's it about?
About a woman that goes on a bit of a revenge rampage, I think.
Right.
And she really has transformed again in it. But ever since To Die For, which was a very long time ago, she's a great actor. She's so good. And I always got really upset when people, had these stupid comments about her nose in The Hours, and that became a big thing in the media about, winning the Oscar, because of the nose and whatnot. Give me a break. That is one of the greatest performances. I mean, everybody is good in The Hours. There's no doubt about that. The whole ensemble cast is brilliant. But she just nails that role. But she does a lot in a lot of her films. She's really committed. I love watching her.
What about?
And in Moulin Rouge in particular, it's a tough role. That's a really tough role. And a challenging role for her. I mean, that would have been really, I don't think she'd sang that much before in a film. If at all. And so to have that confidence as well to do that and take those risks, that's what she does, and she's and constantly pushing her craft. I admire it.
Well, she got the Oscar nomination, lost out to Halle Berry for Monsters Ball, which I haven't seen. Have you seen that?
I have, and that's a great performance. So that's another good performance. So, but
the best director, the fact that Lerman didn't even get a nomination.
A travesty. Travesty.
I mean, good competition. So you had Peter Jackson for one of the Lord of the Rings films.
Yeah, you
had David Lynch for Mulholland Drive.
Yeah, that's great too.
Ridley Scott for Black Hawk Down, which I haven't seen.
No. Moulin Rouge over that any day.
Ron Howard won for A Beautiful Mind. And then you've got Robert Altman for Gosford Park, which I saw and enjoyed, but it's not a great film.
I think Gosford Park
is great, but it's been surpassed by Downton Abbey, and I think it's pretty much forgotten.
This deserved to take up one of these three places. Ron Howard for A Beautiful Mind.
Who won.
But
and won Best Picture still, as well.
And it won Best Picture as well. And I still think it's an okay film, yeah. But it's not a Best Picture. I really don't think so.
I agree.
I like it, but it's not the Best Picture material. Then you've got Black Hawk Down, which is just a war film. It's a good movie, but again, it's just a war film. Whereas this film is different. It's got a different directorial style.
It kind of shouts out gleefully.
It does. It's new and it is unique. So applaud that, Academy. Like, just, and how can you give a film? This is what I couldn't understand at the time. How can you give a film 7 Academy Award nominations and not give it Best Director? You can give it a Best Picture nomination and all the other ones, but you can't. I mean, the director. if there's any film where a director is going to have an absolute stamp on this work, it's Baz Luhrmann. He deserved a Best Director nomination. Absolutely.
Look
for that.
I'm with you. Also, as part of my prep, I went back and watched Baz Luhrmann films. So I've always loved Strictly Ballroom, which I didn't really watch this time around, but I love Strictly Ballroom. I love Moulin Rouge. I tried watching Romeo plus Juliet, or Romeo and Juliet, however you say it, some years ago and couldn't get into it. I sat down and watched it again. And it's interesting because I think it's very similar to Moulin Rouge, which it predates.
Yes.
Because both films, very early on, they fling you into this world of energy and passion, and I suspect a lot of editing, like you say, for both of them. And you have to roll for it or you don't. And for Romeo and Juliet,
true.
I didn't. All the kind of the gangland shootings at the petrol station and so on, not my kind of film. So that's why I stopped last time. But this time I kind of just let it go. And once it really got going beyond that, there were so many things that were so beautifully done in that. Finally watched his Great Gatsby, which, never having read the book or seen the other 1974 film with Robert Redford and Mia Farrow, I really enjoyed that. I thought it was a very intelligent telling. I really tried to watch Australia again. I couldn't get past the first 10 minutes. It just feels so naff. I skipped through it trying to find, is there a better point to enter the film? And to me, that film's an aberration. And it's one of the few films, I think, that he did not co-write with Craig Pearce. So I don't know if that's part of what's going on. There's something wrong with that film that just, he lost his touch, whereas I think everything else he's done I really like.
Well, look, I find Romeo and Juliet is almost a perfect film. I think it's a great adaptation. And I think Shakespeare would have loved it.
It pretty much used his language all the way through.
But the performances, the way he played the characters, Mercutio is wonderful. Tybalt is fantastic. I mean, everybody is so good in it and the way they put it together.
I thought that the two fathers, the patriarchs,
they were brilliant.
I thought he was overacting. Sorry.
No, not at all.
And Brian Dennehy had almost nothing to do.
I know he didn't, but that's the character. But no, I think he was fine, and so was Paul Sorvino. Yeah. I always loved Paul Rudd in it because I always found him quite hilarious, even as Paris. But I think it's a near perfect film. It really is. It's so visually wonderful, and it's a great adaptation.
Do you prefer that over Moulin Rouge?
I do, actually. I think when I first saw it in '96, I think I saw it 4 times at the cinema in 1 week. I watched it so many times. It was just so brilliantly done. It's a great story. I love Romeo and Juliet.
Look how many times it's been repurposed, like West Side Story, for example.
And that's probably the best rendition of it I've seen.
Better than West Side Story?
Yes.
You know that's being remade at the moment?
I do. Spielberg, yeah, he is. Yeah, The Great Gatsby, I enjoyed. You know, I did enjoy it. You know, it's definitely not on par with those other.
No, I don't think so either.
The first three, but Australia, I agree with you. Look, I know some people really enjoyed it.
Really?
But I do. But I couldn't get into it at all. Moulin Rouge is wonderful.
It is.
What are you going to give it, Greg?
I'm giving it a 9.
Wow.
And I'm giving it a 9 rather than a 10 because I'm not convinced about the Like a Virgin sequence.
Yeah.
I think it doesn't let it down, but it kind of doesn't. It doesn't quite spark in the same way for me as the rest of it. But I just think there's so many things going right in this film. I had forgotten, but loved the lover's song, Come What May. I think it's a wonderful, wonderful song.
It is.
I don't understand why it was ineligible for the Oscar, apparently because it was written for Romeo and Juliet, but I then went and watched Romeo and Juliet. It's not in the film that I can spot. So, and again, when I look at the songs, I went back and listened to the songs from that year's Oscars, and they're all pretty nothing special. If it had been allowed in, I think it would have blitzed the field. It's just a wonderful song. I just think everything in this is really working, except for Like a Virgin.
I was erring on an 8 for this out of 10. This is before I rewatched it because I love the film and I thought, oh, it's about an 8. And then I rewatched it and I just couldn't stop watching it. It was just every part was great and I enjoyed it. So I'm giving it a 9 as well.
Cool.
I upped it to a 9 just after watching it again. So I'm giving it a 9. I think I've said why. I think it's a wonderful film. And
why don't you think it's a 10?
It's not Romeo and Juliet.
Fair cop. I'd probably switch them around, but fair cop. And now for our second film, looking back to season one. Ricardo, why don't you tell us about 2007's Irish film musical, Once.
Directed by John Carney, who has gone on to direct other musical films, Begin Again and Sing Street, this 2007 film begins with a busker, singer, songwriter, Glenn Hansard, who is also the lead singer of the band The Frames, who is back in Dublin, Ireland, after breaking up with his girlfriend in London. And he's feeling the heartbreak as he performs. With guitar in hand, his deep and emotional songs on the street. He breaks up his days working with his dad in a vacuum repair shop. Enter Czech immigrant girl, Markéta Irglova, who listens to him on the street. She works odd jobs here and there, but she's also a pianist and singer. She's also separated from her husband and is living with her mum and her daughter. Their musical interests bond them together. He hears her play the piano in a music store, which starts an impromptu jam session working on one of his songs, Falling Slowly. Then they collaborate on some songwriting and then raise some funds to record these in a recording studio. These two have a special connection. They both actually love each other, but this is complicated by things happening in their personal lives. But the special thing about this movie, though, is that it's not about romantic personal love. It's about a creative love. They make love through their music, and that is the thing which ignites them together. This film doesn't even give the lead characters names. They are in the credits as guy and girl. But the music they create is just magical. It wasn't a surprise when they won the Academy Award for Best Original Song for Falling Slowly. It is also no surprise that this film became a Broadway smash hit musical. The movie was shot with a skeleton crew for around $100,000 on two Sony HDV cameras. They used natural light, and it was shot in Dublin in 17 days, and they did this without permits. They used long lenses, so the actors didn't have to worry about the cameras so much, especially in the street scenes. So none of the people in the streets are extras. They are real people who have no idea a film is being shot. Now, while Glenn Hansard had some acting experience in the 1991 Alan Parker film, The Commitments, Markéta had no acting experience at all, and she is just so lovely. These two, who got together for a little while after filming, just connected so well on screen. Look, this film may be small, but it's an absolute gem. I remember I spent one day editing with Australian director Mark Gracie back in 2007, and he said it was the film of the year. And at that time, I just wasn't being moved. I think I said this in season one. I just wasn't being moved much by cinema at the time. Well, I hired it straight away from the DVD store and was so moved by this film. I watched it every day for a week. And as a creator myself, it just spoke to me and still does. It's original and just so authentic. I just love this film. Now, Greg, what do you think? And please tread carefully here.
This is me treading carefully. Have you seen the Broadway musical?
No.
We saw it when it came to Melbourne a few years ago. And my wife and I, in particular, we loved it, really enjoyed it. I actually can't remember too much about the story. I just remember enjoying the experience. So I was looking forward to this.
And, don't. Please.
I think this is the end of the podcast.
Stop.
I'm sorry. I'm sorry.
What?
I can't lie. I made a note to myself 20 minutes in. I'm not a fan. And by that stage, I realised I wasn't going to like the film. I didn't remotely like it. Get the size out of you.
Oh, my God.
It's interesting.
Okay. Hang on. Okay. Tell me what you didn't like about the film. I'm a bit shocked.
I know. And I am sorry. look, it started with the camera work. And where it really started to annoy me is in that scene that I think you like so much in the music shop.
Yes.
When they're singing, that was the hit song, wasn't it? That they were singing at that point.
Yeah.
What's it called?
Falling Slowly.
Thank you. Which was one of the two songs I liked in the film. I also liked the one she sang on the way to buy batteries, or on the way back from buying batteries.
Yeah. Yes.
I assume it's called Satisfy Me or something like that. But the camera work was bobbing around the piano. And I actually found that really annoying. And it really pulled me out of the story. And I really started noticing that the camera work was clumsy all the way through. And where it really didn't work for me is when she was walking back from the battery shop and singing the Satisfy Me song.
Yes.
The camera work was so jerky. And that's usually a signal in a film for something's about to happen. It's something bad. Yeah. I was waiting for someone to either attack her and steal the CD Walkman. Or,
oh my God, I didn't get that at all.
Or for her to suddenly get hit by a car coming off the street.
Really? Oh, come
no,
on.
No, I was waiting. Really? It's you know David Stratton, Australian film reviewer?
Yes.
Margaret and David, for those who are locals. And he has this aversion to handheld camera work.
That's right.
I don't feel that as strongly as him. I think sometimes it has its place. But for me, it didn't work here. And I didn't know the background of what you were saying about, you know, they were shooting without people realising. I knew it was a very low budget. I knew that Glenn Hansard was a last-minute rope-in because somebody dropped out from that part, so he came without a lot of prep time. I found the fact that they were only ever called girl and guy, I thought that was an affectation. I couldn't believe that they never asked each other's names or used them in conversation. That made it, again, artificial for me. My younger son, my 15-year-old son, said a few times, it's like someone's bad home movie. And that's how I felt. I'm sorry, it just didn't. It's got a couple of nice songs in it, but that doesn't make a movie for me. I agree, she's got a lot of charm. She was only about 17, I think, when she made this film.
Wow, yeah, I can't believe that's how old she
was.
Well,
I think that has a lot to say about the natural presence and poise that she brings to the part. I actually
wonderful.
Liked her performance, but I didn't like the film. I'm sorry. And I know that for some people, this is, as you said yourself, a near-perfect film. For some people I've spoken to, it's their favourite film or right up there on their favourite films.
This doesn't need a big budget.
No, it didn't. Right? It didn't work. I wasn't the hugest fan of the music either.
But, oh my goodness me.
I found some of it just too wailing.
You know, when I first saw it, the very first song to the last, it had me the whole way, and quite honestly, I get really emotional when I at the end of it, when he buys her the piano and she's looking out the window with that gorgeous shot out the window when she's back with her husband and when he goes back to London, it's so moving to me. And like I said, I think it's a tale of struggling artists, you know, and wanting to create and creating this bond of creativity. For a lot of films, this sort of low budget, sort of handheld, sort of a documentary style filmmaking, it doesn't work. This film, I think it does completely, because it's like you're just entering these two musicians' worlds, and you've just come in and you're watching them on the street, and you're watching them, you know, like a voyeur of this creative partnership. Yes, look, like yes, the camera work and the cinematography isn't amazing, but it's not about that. I just fell in love with their journey and the love story of this and the creation of it.
Well, look, it's got more to say to you as someone who is actively involved in the creative arts. I get that. Yeah, I get that, yeah, and I hope I'm not being patronizing when I say that. I get that would speak to you. It didn't speak to me. I kept waiting for something to happen. And that's, I think, why when she was walking back from the battery shop and the camera work was so jerky, I thought, this must be where the story really takes off. And it didn't.
No.
But
no.
The
beauty is that it doesn't do that.
Yeah. But I have to say, the surprising thing for me about my response to this is that John Carney, who wrote and directed this, also directed and I think wrote Sing Street, which I've yet to see, but I understand is really rather wonderful. But he did write and direct the first three episodes of a show on Amazon Prime this year called Modern Love. I don't know. I don't think you've seen that, have you?
Oh, I've not seen it. But I saw Begin Again, which is his other film with Keira Knightley. Yep. And I really enjoyed that.
Well, in Modern Love, there's about, I don't know, 10 or 12 episodes, or maybe 8, whatever it is. And we watched that and we thought the first three episodes were just marvellous. They were really wonderful. They were funny, sad. I got weepy at least in the first one. The first three were fantastic, and then the quality kind of tailed off. He wrote and directed the first three.
He's a very good director and writer.
Yeah, I think he is.
I really look forward to seeing Sing Street. He was a band member of The Frames, which is Glenn Hansard's band.
Okay.
But then he I think he really loved the idea of directing in films, and this is where Once came in, because a lot of the music there is from The Frames album, which Glenn Hansard wrote. So they already knew each other, and they put this thing together in 17 days. To put a film like this together in 17 days is a revelation, and see what they did. And the fact that the actors hadn't really done that much acting work, they were used to just being singer-songwriters.
And that is all technically impressive, but it didn't work for me, I'm sorry.
Well, that's disappointing.
I kind of worked that much out.
Very disappointing.
Like I said, this is obviously the last ever episode of the podcast.
Very disappointing.
And I'm trying to tread carefully on your dreams. The song is not bad, but I have to say that when you look at...
Not bad?
Not bad.
It's an Academy Award winning
song.
Yes,
but what was it up against?
I don't know.
I'll tell you.
And I don't really...
I looked it up.
It was wonderful.
It was up against three songs from the same movie, which I quite like. Disney's Enchanted film with Amy Adams. One song which is nice but fairly forgettable. One song, I can't remember, it might have been okay. There was the song in the park about love called That's How You Know, which I quite like, but I don't think it's a great song. So it was up against those three songs being chanted and a song called Raise It Up from August Rush, which I have neither seen the film or heard the song, so I don't know what that is. But again,
right,
not a lot of competition. Come What May would have walked all over it from my perspective.
I think it's a beautiful song. It's where they really connect. I think it's a great piece. And, I love that scene in the music store. I completely disagree with you with the camera work there. I think it's lovely. You're just watching these two connect.
I
wait for that sequence. I love that sequence.
I think a lot of people will agree with you who are listening to us. Mm. But I think there'll be a kernel of people who are with me as well. I looked at some of the reviews on IMDb, and all the first ones in the list, they're all 10s, 9s, and a few 8s and so on.
Yeah.
But as you go down the list, there are some very low scores, and I have to say I sit with them. So it doesn't work for everyone, and I'm one of the ones in that outside-looking-in group.
Look, it's not a perfect film. I'm not going to give this a 10. It's not a perfect film because technically it's not perfect, but it moved me. No, so I'm going to give you my score now. Like I'm going to give it a 9 out of 10, and that's only because of the some technical aspects of it. But I think it's just brilliant. I can watch it so many times and not get bored. It's wonderful.
I'll never watch it again.
God,
for me, it's a 3 out of 10.
Jeepers!
I think it makes Cabaret look good.
3 out of 10.
Yeah, I'm sorry. All three of us, it just did not engage us. We were just kind of looking at it.
Oh, my goodness. I'm shocked by that score. I thought at least a 5.
No, no.
Come on.
No.
It had a lot of heart.
I started out giving it a 1.
You've got to be kidding me.
No.
Do you know, I think I'm pretty sure I remember Lee Patch from the Herald Sun giving it a 1-star review. I may be wrong, but I think I remember that and thinking, oh, jeepers, that was harsh, because it got also 5-star and 4-star reviews. And I've been trying to find that review just to make sure that that was right, and I'm pretty sure it is. But I thought to myself, I don't know how you could give this film that score. So to hear you say that,
well,
you are now Lee Patch territory.
I was going to say maybe Lee and I will have to go out for a drink once quarantine's over.
Oh my goodness! Okay, that is all I have to say about Once, and I'm going to end the conversation there before I get too upset.
Well, I'll just finish by saying that's how often I'm going to watch the film.
So the third film we're going to discuss is the 1979 Bob Fosse film, All That Jazz.
So we are still going to talk about
jazz.
We are still going to talk about films of each other, are we?
Yes, we are.
Okay. Sorry.
After that, yes, we are. We will continue. Take it away, Greg.
Okay. Now that our audience has lost complete confidence in my opinion, All That Jazz. I have fond memories of this 1979 film, as it was the first grown-up movie I went to see on my own. And that's appropriate, because while this film is personal for me, it most certainly was for director, choreographer and co-writer Bob Fosse. The story is based on Fosse's life in 1975, when he was desperately trying to edit his film Lenny, about a stand-up comic, while simultaneously staging the Broadway musical Chicago, which includes the song All That Jazz, all of which led to his heart attack. So we see Fosse's alter ego, Joe Gideon, Roy Scheider, desperately trying to edit his film The Stand-Up while simultaneously staging a Broadway musical called NYLA. While juggling these two projects, Gideon is also juggling the women in his life, including his ex-wife Audrey, Leland Palmer, based on Fosse's real-life ex, Gwen Verdon, his girlfriend Kate, Anne Ryan King, based on Fosse's real-life girlfriend, Anne Ryan King, an NYLA cast member, Deborah Geffner, with whom he starts an affair, and Angelique, the Angel of Death, Jessica Lange, with whom he flirts, getting closer and closer to her as the film progresses and his health deteriorates. The fifth female is his teenage daughter, Michelle, Erzbeth Foldy, who is based on Fosse's real-life daughter, Nicole. There's not a whole lot of biographical disguising going on here. Every morning, Gideon starts his day with a shower, cigarette, drugs and eye drops, all to a pulsing Vivaldi soundtrack, before using jazz hands to announce to his mirror, "It's showtime, folks." This repeated sequence communicates the hamster wheel that is Gideon's life, and it's become a touch point for such recent TV shows as Glow and Better Call Saul. So it's small wonder that Gideon, who, like Fosse, is rarely without a cigarette in his mouth, ends up in hospital with a heart attack. But even there, the booze, drugs, carousing and womanising don't stop, despite his doctor's warnings. Gideon ends up in cardiac surgery, which becomes a series of big Hollywood dance numbers that he films in his fevered imagination. The movie climaxes with a centre stage Broadway celebration in front of the people from his life, as he sings a duet with shallow celebrity O'Connor Flood, Ben Vereen, and the Everly Brothers lyrics in Bye Bye Love take on new meaning as Gideon sings, "I think I'm gonna die," while joyously hugging these people in farewell. The curious thing about this film is that Gideon, and by extension Fosse, can clearly see what's important in his life, but he seems unable to get off the hamster wheel that leads inexorably to his death. The film ends harshly with Gideon zipped into a body bag and then swells into Ethel Merman singing "There's No Business Like Show Business" over the black and white end credits, followed by silence. And Fosse followed 8 years later, having a heart attack at only 60 years old, in the arms of his ex-wife, Gwen Verdon, outside the opening night of his Chicago revival. All That Jazz has many memorable scenes, such as a cattle call audition at the beginning, daughter Michelle dancing with girlfriend Kate down a staircase with huge kicks from Anne Reinking's long, nimble legs, leading to Gideon embracing and relishing these two people in his life. The surgery hallucination dance numbers, which highlight Lillian Palmer's big, luminous eyes. A sequence from Gideon's film that uses Elizabeth Kubler-Ross's Stages of Dying as a stand-up routine, which then come back to drive his delirium. And a passionate kiss that consoles an old woman in pain elsewhere in the hospital. There's a scene too where Fosse works out a dance routine while talking with his daughter, which the recent Fosse Verdon TV show evidenced as one of many moments that Fosse directly copied from his own life. But probably the part that has stayed with me longest is the startlingly erotic dance number Erotica. Particularly startling to this virginal 18-year-old who had little idea that men or women shared sexual activity. It was also the first time I got Fosse, as we see him use the human body and a smoke machine to transform a blandly forgettable tune into something visually striking and stylistically unique. And in the middle of this eroticism, there's also humour in the responses of the witnesses, the composer saying, "Now Sinatra will never record it," or the producer, "Uh-oh, I think we just lost the family audience." Ricardo, I've been known to say that you lose our family audience. How did you go with All That Jazz?
You know, I'd seen it before, but a long time ago. You know I'm a big fan of Cabaret.
Yes, I've noticed that.
Yeah, from season one.
A love which we almost share.
Yeah. This is not that, but it's close. You know, he sure knows how to end a movie from that freeze frame on the Nazi sign at the end of Cabaret, in the glass, I think it is, to this ending of just the zipping up of a body bag. What a great sequence that whole end sequence is. Look, being in the theatre, I've worked in the theatre, both on stage and behind stage, backstage, so I've seen a lot of different, I've seen the theatre from many different vantage points, from 10 years working backstage on staging, but I've performed in so many shows as well. I loved it from that perspective because it does show, it's quite realistic in that sort of audition sense and the waiting around.
Well, the audition actually, was it an audition, did you know that?
So it was.
The principal dancers had been cast beforehand, but everyone else turning up for the cattle call, they were there for a cattle call. And some of them recognised Scheider and thought there's something else going on here. But a lot of what you see there is genuine.
Well, it feels genuine. The table reads they have, it's all very real. I mean, it just, you know, and so I feel like I'm watching a documentary when I'm watching this. But Gideon and his performance and Roy Scheider's performance. Now, I'd seen him in Jaws, and I knew him as the Jaws guy.
Yeah.
Because I watched Jaws when I was younger, and I loved him in that role. And then but seeing him in this, he is wonderful. His love for the theatre, his love for his work, but then also he's just so tired of the world around that. You know, talking to the producers and hearing a table read. That table read section is very well done when all you hear is
the pen tapping.
The
breath. The,
yeah,
that, I
that's
think.
What he.
Yeah.
He's just not listening. He's not there. You know, there's those moments which I really loved stylistically. He's a very, very good director. Unlike Cabaret, which I don't think has dated that much. I think this has dated a little as a film, but it's just so beautifully made. Yeah, the whole end sequence when he's looking at his life in front of him, singing he's going to die, I've never seen anything like it. And again, we're talking about Moulin Rouge. It's one of those films you're never going to see anything like.
Yeah.
This is one of those. Yeah. And also the scene, which I couldn't really watch. I forgot it was there. But there's that sequence where the producers are talking about how they're going to make money off this,
oh, yeah.
Gideon, you know, and they're showing the, you know, them cutting open and giving him his open heart surgery at exactly the same time.
Mm.
It's quite an amazing sequence. This is a dark portrayal of that world.
Oh yeah,
and it really is. It's so dark that it's almost like
the bits around the producers are dark.
Yeah, absolutely.
And the banality. Saying,
they can actually make money from not going on. I mean, that's just opening up his heart there. Like, really.
Well, that's the producers. Remember, that's the storyline in the producers.
Jessica Lange's Angelique. I think those sequences there have dated quite a bit.
Yeah, I'd go for there, actually. You
know, yeah. But still, when he's going down the hallway
towards
the light or towards her, it really is. I mean, it's unlike anything you're ever going to see.
I don't think it's dated as much as I suspect you do. I think Cabaret has dated, so we're going to disagree there. But you know I wasn't a great fan to start with.
We will always disagree.
We will always have Cabaret, Ricardo. see, to me, this is clearly different and, to my mind, better than Cabaret, because you might remember that one of my problems with Cabaret was I didn't believe the central relationship between Michael York and Liza Minnelli. I believe the relationship's here, mainly because he's just ripped it out of his own life and, in fact,
he put his
ex-girlfriend in as his girlfriend. It's to me, it's very real, and it makes it sad because you can clearly see, as he can clearly see, that he's on this bad path. And even the act of making the film couldn't get him out of that behaviour pattern. So he lasted another, 8 years, and then his body just gave up.
The relationship between him and his daughter is quite moving because I think he can see that he's not a great father.
Yeah.
You know, he's not there for her, but he really wants to be.
Well, I think he can see that he's just not great to all the women in his life. He either
uses
them. Yeah. Like he's a serial adulterer, like Fosse himself.
Yes. And they all know that.
Yeah, I know, but that doesn't make it right.
No, definitely not. Definitely not. He talks about, when he says, I really love you. And I think Jessica Lange, the angel character, was like, did you mean that? Well, not really. I don't know. I just say these things, you know. So
how do you think the ex-girlfriend felt when she would have seen that line in the film?
Oh, yeah.
Because he was really talking about her. That's him talking about her in real life. And I think there's a lot of sadness in this film. Not necessarily... in the film, strictly speaking, per se, there is, but there's another layer of sadness, another depth, which is when you know about his life and how much this is his life, and you realise how much is being screwed up. And he can see the tragedy is. He can see it, but he can't stop it.
That's right. Yeah.
Do you know who was meant cast in the Joe Gideon part? This is one of my little bits of trivia.
Yeah, sure. Go for it. Yeah.
And I don't think it would have worked, frankly. Richard Dreyfuss.
Oh, definitely not.
No.
Definitely not. Both of them in Jaws.
Yes, I know. This is the... maybe Jaws should be turned into a Fosse musical. You know, I've never actually seen Jaws.
I'm going to eat the shark.
Yeah, I haven't seen Jaws. And this is the first film that I saw John Lithgow in.
He's good in it.
He is. His part is meant to be Hal Prince. So I think Fosse uses this film to have a go at a couple of people and probably the producers of Chicago as well, I suspect. I noticed Lithgow in this. I really noticed him, I think, the following year in The World According to Garp, where he plays Robert Roberta, that he was fantastic. And that's the first time I really noticed him. Mm. But I did notice him in this. Did you notice there were actually a few early performances here? Did you see who was making notes and had a line or two as an insurance man in that scene where they said, we can make money out of this?
No, who was
it? Go back and look. It's Wallace Shawn.
Oh, yes. I did notice him. Yes, I did.
This is his...
Inconceivable.
Yes, that's the guy. I couldn't remember the line. I'm sorry. This is his fourth film role ever as, quote, assistant insurance man. I don't know if you know who CCH Pounder is, but she's in a lot of...
What a name.
I know. Well, she's in quite a few kind of sci-fi kind of shows like Warehouse 13. Right. Where she plays a very mysterious character. She plays one of the nurses. I don't know where because I haven't spotted her, but apparently his real-life daughter, Nicole Fosse, cameos as a dancer somewhere in the film. I wish I knew where that scene was. So there's a lot of good people in this film. I just think it works on so many levels.
I think I loved it when it, because it starts off like just a normal film, and there's no sort of musical numbers to it. But it's sort of when he has his heart attack and his imagination starts really kicking in, that his life starts flashing back in front of him and he starts becoming a musical. You're seeing a lot of the musical numbers come through.
Yep.
But his style is just so good. It's just when you can label a style as your name, that's Fosse. You know, you've created something really special, and he's got a style. The closest movie to get Bob Fosse's style is Chicago, the movie from 2000.
Well, that's because it's a film of his stage show.
Well, I know that, but to actually get the choreography right and to get it, you know, it's wonderful. But Fosse's Fosse, and he's brilliant.
What did you think of the Erotica number?
Yeah, it was great. It was a good number. It was great. I mean, it was okay. I still think it's dated a bit. Again, I still think some of those sequences have dated a bit, but, you know.
I think it's dated. Like, the film stock seems to have aged a bit or something, but I think the number's still very contemporary.
Yes, and sometimes no, though. Yeah. The music numbers in this aren't like Cabaret or Chicago. Yeah, I'm not going to go away singing those songs, whereas in Chicago, there's every song. You know, in Cabaret, there's a lot of songs in there which I just love.
No, I sit there and marvel at them. You know, one thing I noticed this time around that I don't remember noticing before is how much he films dancers sweating. Like, there's a lot of naked bodies. There's a lot of women's breasts in this film.
Oh, there is.
Which is pretty Fosse, I suspect. But he really shows the pain and sweat of dancers, that it's actually, you know, highly physically exerting, rather than what you normally get in dance films and musicals, which is everyone sweat-free and just dancing happily to a song and so on. He really shows the work that goes into it.
Performers have such thick skins, they get rejected an awful lot. And I think there were some of those sequences in there where he was telling them no next time, or he was, you know, and to see the disappointment on their faces. I mean, that's very real. You know, you try, you rehearse, you do the best audition you possibly can, only to be rejected again and again and again. And then that one time where you get it, it's a wonder.
Do you know who I loved in this film? I don't remember noticing before. In the very early scene in the auditions, the guy in black who could not dance.
Oh, who couldn't dance, and they laughed at him.
Well, I looked at him and I thought, that's me.
Yeah.
But I listened to some commentary by the film's editor, and he was saying, I don't actually know if that guy was real or put up. I never found out. He might have just shown up.
But they were laughing at him, the daughter and the one.
Yeah, well, he was pretty bad.
It was very bad, but that's what happens when you have an open call, you know.
Yep.
But you know what I was thinking? I was thinking, geez, there's a lot of people on stage. How the hell can you move?
Yeah, I know.
You know?
But then you get those great shots of all that, the arms going up in the air.
Yeah.
Those are just, again, they're kind of emblematic of the film and his style. It just works.
Yeah.
It's a very simple shot, and it just works.
Yes.
Do you know, I've got two...
But it even had the annoying characters, because you get a lot of annoying people in the entertainment world. When he had his heart attack and they were still all rehearsing, and there was a guy that said, I've got a song for that, I've got a song
that
for that.
That was the composer, yeah.
The composer. Yeah,
he was irritating.
He was irritating, really irritating.
And you wonder who he's based on.
You get people like that in there. Yeah, well, you get people like that, yeah.
I've got a couple of little things to share with you. Stanley Kubrick apparently called this the best film I think I've ever seen.
Oh, wow.
Yep. And in 2012, the Motion Picture Editors Guild listed it as the fourth best edited film of all time, based on a survey of its membership. Do you want to know what came ahead of it? By peers, Raging Bull, Citizen Kane, and Apocalypse Now. So ranked fourth behind those. That's pretty impressive.
Yeah, that is. I mean, it is beautifully made. You can't doubt that.
You know, on a trivial level, this film has probably been one of the most influential on my life in a very simple kind of way, which is there are times, you know, there are times when everyone gets up and they have to go to work and you just don't feel like it. You'd rather be somewhere else. You're not feeling well, but you're not sick enough to stay home. My little strategy then is to look in the mirror with the jazz hands and go, it's showtime. That's how I move forward. That's very much from this film. So what are you going to give this?
Oh, look, I'm giving it a 9 out of 10.
Oh, really? The way you spoke, I thought you were going to go lower.
No, because I still think of its time. It's a brilliant film. You're not going to see anything like it. I still think for a film like this, even though I think it's dated a little bit, it's still magnificent and still beautifully made and something you're not going to see again. And the personal nature of it is something you're not going to see. And the way that it is edited, the way that it is put together, it's very, very good.
That scene where he's kissing the woman who's obviously dying of something terrible.
Oh,
and it just erases that.
Yes, that's right.
It's a beautiful moment.
But it's not Cabaret. That's 10, so it's 9.
Well, you're right. It's not Cabaret. but for me, it's also a 9.
Yeah, right. And what makes you not give it a 10?
I don't think this film will be for everyone. I think you'll like it or you won't. Maybe because of numbers like Erotica. Some people, I think, will find that a bit confronting, even now, you know, what is it? 40 years later. I feel that the final concert number, I thought it went on a little bit too long.
It does, but he's dying.
Yeah, I know. I just don't think it's quite there as a 10 for me, but there's so much in this, deliberately and perhaps a little bit accidentally, about this is actually a man's life. And I feel, I literally feel sad when I think about that the clear-eyedness with which he can see his life and the path it's on, and the fact that became a fulfilling prophecy. And not only for him, but for his co-writer, Robert Allen Author, I think it's pronounced, died before the film was released. Again, lung cancer, 56.
Wow.
Because he was writer-producer, he got 2 posthumous Academy Award nominations, but he didn't even get, unlike Fosse, he didn't even get to see the fulfillment of this piece of work they'd both written. And I don't want to be too judgmental or glib about, you know, we're not knowing this guy at all, his lifestyle and how that led to his death. But, you know, the two men at the heart of creating this work both died very young, and I suspect...
Yeah, they did.
It's kind of the story playing itself out in their lives. And I enjoy the film. I don't feel particularly sad when I watch it, but when I stop and think about it, yeah, I feel sad.
Oh, it ends on such a dark note, though. Seeing him just be zipped up into a body bag, all you hear is the zip.
Yeah.
After so much song and dance, it just goes to silent zip.
You're right, it's perfectly judged.
It's beautifully judged. And it, like I said, he really knows how to end a movie well and give you that feeling. Oh,
but then you get Ethel Merman doing that, you know, there's no business, show business.
But
when she finishes, then it's silent.
It's a dark betrayal. It's a really dark betrayal of the business. It really is. So that concludes episode 2, season 4 of our Filmmaker Film Watcher podcast. We hope you've enjoyed that.
Certainly one of us faced the music with that middle film once.
Please watch them all. They are very good, and they're all unique in their own way.
So moving on to our next episode, we're doing something that's kind of like what we've done before. Regular listeners might remember that we went and asked the women in our lives, our partners and my mum, to nominate films that they would like to watch with us. We're going down the generation tree to ask our sons. So I've got 2 sons, we mention often. Ricardo's got a son. So we're calling this episode Our 3 Sons.
Look, I think this is a wonderful idea. There are a lot of times where we're watching movies for this podcast where I have to have my boy in bed by a certain time.
Whereas I've got the opposite problem. Come and watch this film with me. Oh, I don't want to watch that film.
Yeah. Well, the thing is, we've been doing this podcast for now 5 years.
Yep.
So my son was 5 when we started this podcast, and he's now 10. So and yours, you know, the same.
Yep.
So they've grown up with us doing this podcast. So I think it's about time that we give them a choice of and so I can watch actually something with them.
So we turn around and ask them, what would you recommend? What would you watch with us? In my case. And so my younger son has chosen Star Wars: A New Hope. So that's the very, very first Star Wars film from 1977. I have to say, he's a bit of a Star Wars... No, he's actually quite a big Star Wars geek. So we'll have to tread carefully there. And what about your son?
Well, I think we have to tread carefully there in general. It's such a massive franchise and it's such a very well-loved film. My son chose... 2018's Steven Spielberg film Ready Player One. So that's a really good one to choose. So we'll be watching that one and then discussing that.
And the third film we'll do next time is 1995, The Usual Suspects. Not my usual kind of film, although I have seen all three of these films before. One that I'm looking forward to actually watching with him and even asking him, what does he reckon about it?
Yeah, I'm looking forward to rewatching The Usual Suspects, because I haven't seen it for a very long time. And so, yeah, I'm really looking forward to seeing that again. I've seen Star Wars many times, so it's going to be quite a fun discussion. But whereas I think The Usual Suspects, it was one of my favourites back in 95. So, but I haven't watched it a lot.
I've seen all the Star Wars decades, films, really. But I think I've only seen each one only once, including the first one.
Oh, okay.
A long, long, long time ago in a galaxy far, far away.
Far, far away. Well, thank you for listening to our podcast. Please visit our Facebook page, like us on our Facebook page, subscribe to our podcast. We can be listened to on iTunes, on Spotify, on Google Play now, many different platforms we can be listened to on. So please give us a shout out. Comment on our Facebook page, we'll respond back.
And if you're a particular fan of Once, please don't hate me.